Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to violence.
Welcome to Lost in the Static.
Welcome to another wasted Saturday night, and I don't mean wasted in the wasted sense, but in the wasted sense, which doesn't make any sense either. Anyway, I'm Josh Hadley. With me, as always, from across the bond, is Glenn Criddle.
Oh, good day to you.
That was like Australian. It's a different across
the bond. No, that'd be good day.
So are you saying it's just the inflection of the accent, not the accent itself?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. Yeah, the Australians would be like good day. And this was good day to you, sir.
Oh, so you're more polite.
It's lost on you, isn't it?
Yes. You're more polite. Okay, I get it. All right, and then with me, as always, is Sarah Hanley.
We are the Misfits.
We'll actually be talking about how the Misfits are not bitter anymore, and they're not going to get her. But before that, what you guys can do if you really want to do get her, you go to adamandeve.com. You use the promo code STATIC, and you will get 10 free gifts on top of whatever you order. You'll get 6 free DVDs, a free mystery gift, a gift for him, a gift for her, and free U.S. shipping. And also, if you're into role-playing, not the sexual kind of role-playing, but role-playing games, you can go to drivethroughrpg.com and get Al Seeger's interesting systemless settings bundle and the other really cool role-playing game things he has at drivethroughrpg.com. Just tell him Lost in the Static sent you. Now, this show is obviously not produced very well. I'm not that great of a producer. We kind of do this show off the cuff. But some things are overly produced. Glenn, since you brought up this topic, which also segues later into a topic that Sarah brought up, but we'll get into that, what made you think of sort of the overproduction? I mean, I'm setting you up since I obviously know.
Well, I recently went to watch the Mad Max film, the new one, and before anybody kind of starts writing in the comments, I think it's a great film, really, really enjoyable, but there was things about it, a couple of things about it, which really just took the edge off of it being an entirely amazing film, in my opinion. And the example I gave was with the cinematography of it. It's been designed in such a way to be kind of produced as a 3D film at the expense of its quality as a 2D film, because I watched it in 2D. And I know this is going to sound very odd, but it felt very, very, very flat. And, you know, that I know it's a 2D film. You could say logically it's going to be flat and all that kind of stuff. However, it shouldn't do. Many films manage to look great despite the fact that they're kind of, filmed with about, you know, how they'd kind of thought about a certain aspect of the production and went with that, and it was just done overly to the detriment of the film.
Well, in the case of Mad Max Fury Road, the film was shot in 2D. And was only post-converted to 3D. But I've seen the film as well, and I can attest that there were a few shots that were clearly made for the 3D audience, especially the super rig exploding. That was an absolute 3D shot. But I don't know if it's maybe the difference, because I don't know if PAL or NTSC comes into play when it comes to film and theatrical prints. I didn't have the same issue you did. I thought the film looked great, and it didn't feel flat. It actually had, and I saw it in 2D, a pretty good depth to it. Like when they're flying off the little rockets that with the colors that signal, you know, the war party and whatnot, I thought it actually gave a pretty decent depth to the difference between where those were in the sky to the war rig and all that. So I don't necessarily agree with you. It doesn't make you wrong. It just means I didn't see the same thing you did in that.
No, I mean, possibly it was something to do with it could have even been the projection that was going on. Sometimes that's the case. However, I have noticed it with a lot of films when they're produced here, but even with a lot of CG, whether it's 3D, there's so such a strange kind of construct to the way that the shot is constructed that occasionally it all gets either overwhelmed or it's kind of forced. Like I think it was more with the earlier parts of the film than anything else, but it felt like what's the best way to describe it? Like parallax almost. It was like flat plane, flat plane, flat plane. And that's kind of how that sort of thing feels. And I've certainly felt that with a lot of CG films. And looking at the trailer for something like the new Terminator film, for instance, it looks, again, like it's kind of, it's all flat planes. It's not 3D objects in the shot.
Absolutely agree with you on Terminator Genisys. Just going from the trailer, it is so... I hate to say this because it's going to sound snobbish, but it's the only way I can put it. It looks so HD that it comes out bland. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
that
absolutely.
Makes complete sense. There are questions that none of us right now can answer because we don't have our hands on any of that information of when they took it and they post-converted it. Did they take that post-converted one and put that in the 3D theaters and then they flattened that back out? Because just taking a file and expanding it out, then flattening it back out, and then you compare that to the original one, which didn't get monkeyed around with, they're not going to look the same. It would look better if they had taken the original cut of the film before they had 3D'd it and used that as the 2D version and then put the 3D one in the 3D theaters. That would be the logical and that would be the best for the material.
That would also
as
be the expensive version of that.
Now, but unfortunately, that's not the way that these companies think. They think, well, we spent all that money to put the 3D effects in, and even though by smushing it back down, they're not going to actually see the 3D effects, we're going to use a version that we've already played with and put that one out in the 2D theaters, even though that is going to degrade the film.
Okay,
I
think I can sum this up perfectly. This is a perfect oxymoron here of studio thinking when it comes to this kind of thing. That when it comes to 3D, they're obviously only thinking in two dimensions.
No, I mean, without going off into a massive rant about 3D, I mean, yeah, I don't know if you've ever read the article I wrote about it, but... it's always struck me as this sort of white elephant, basically, this thing that's supposed to be groundbreaking and innovative and the future of cinema. And it's been this how many times in the past? You know, I mean, 3D cinema has been around since pretty much the birth of cinema. People don't realize quite how far it went back.
There was a 3D boom in the 50s. Then there was a small 3D boom in the early 80s. There was a little bit in the 90s where they tried to bring back all those 50s and 80s movies into theaters, and it didn't quite work. And then there was the modern one, which was that 04 that the My Bloody Valentine remake came out? Because that was the first big new 3D one somewhere
around
Josh, there.
But Josh, you're forgetting, even before that, they had entire... in the Nickelodeons, where you had two images, one right next to the other, and then you look into there, and it made it a three-dimensional picture. That they had nudie films that way.
Well, yeah, because you want to think that nipple's going to poke you in the eye.
Well, you're not paying for it to be soft. Come on.
Exactly. But but when it comes to stuff like the 3D and whatnot, I absolutely agree that gets overproduced. But also, like with HD. Because now I only watched the pilot because it was fucking horrendous, but like the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. TV show, it's shot in such HD and shot with HD cameras, it looks so bland and flat, and I hate to say it, low budget. I mean, there's a certain look that like film versus video gives you. And then you've got HD. If you look at like even the Avengers film compared to the pilot of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. looks like a goddamn web series.
It looks soft. The focus doesn't look right. Unfortunately, I saw it as well. I got into 10 minutes of the second episode, and I was like, you know what? I could do so many more things with my life.
Yeah, but overproduction happens all the time. Look at like a Michael Bay film. This is where Glenn and I are going to totally nerd out. Because Glenn and I have both gone off on Michael Bay many times in both positive and the negative. Now, to me, Michael Bay films are absolutely overproduced. At the same time, and Glenn, you may disagree with me on this, I think he is an actual filmmaker because he does know film language. Because you look at how many different disparate elements he has going on in a frame. He'll have a plane flying in the background and a car coming forward, and then the streetlights will be going out, and then the shadows will be falling on the car, and then there'll be a gunfight over here. But it's all set in the traditional film language of telling the story. A lot of people might not agree that Michael Bay is a good storyteller. On a script level, he's not. But on a filmmaking level, he overproduces his stuff so much that it actually shows he does know what he's doing. Or am I overanalyzing that?
I think that it's a situation where you might want to take a hat or two away from him because he does know lighting. He does know angles. He needs to keep the damn camera from moving all the time. So that's where you might have someone else directing the
film. No, see, I even disagree with that because I think Michael Bay does know camera movement very well. Because
he does, but he does it all the time. That's the biggest problem.
Well, right,
yeah,
he doesn't know when to hold it.
No, he has that one trick which he uses again and again and again and again. And the one thing that he does do incredibly well is he really does expand the world outside the frame. It's always that suggestion that there's stuff going on outside the frame, and he does that with the movement of the camera, all that kind of stuff. But it's to the point where I think the best example I can probably give is that scene in, I think it's the first one, where it's a Bernie Mac in the car lot. And it's when he's going to buy Bumblebee.
Mm-hmm.
And it just starts rotating around him and all this kind of stuff. It's just like kind of, oh, for love of God, he's in a car lot. How much of this world around do we need to know?
A perfect example of that would be Pain and Gain. There's mm-hmm. a quiet scene between Ed Harris and his wife where, Ed Harris is retired and she doesn't want him to go back to work as a private detective, but he's taking Tony Shalhoub's case. And there's this, in a traditional movie, it would be a quiet scene of her realizing that he needs to do this for him. And in Pain and Gain, it's this giant epic shot of them just sitting holding one another on a dock, and you've got a boat going in the background and the camera coming in, and it's mm-hmm. like, no, Mike, this needs to be a quiet scene.
It needs to be small. And that's the thing. Michael Bay doesn't do small. He does big.
You know what it reminds me of? I didn't even think about this until now. But before I could see a lot of movies, I knew about the stories basically by reading the Mad Magazine articles, and you know how they just throw every single damn thing into that panel that they possibly can?
I think you're thinking of the Mort Drucker era.
Yes. Yeah, I'm not talking modern. I think that we all don't need to speak of that.
It's fair. I'm just saying the Mort Drucker stuff, as soon as you said crammed everything into the panel that you could, I'm like, that's Mort Drucker.
Yeah, you have a boat in the background, and you have a hang glider, and you have an alien ship going into the moon, and this is all in the scene where he's just looking at his wife.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. But then you have other filmmakers that are the exact opposite, where it should be a loud scene, but you either didn't have the budget or you didn't have the set. Like, I was, for Fangoria Magazine, One of the movies I looked at was Dark Side of the Moon, this 1991 film. Seriously, this is the plot. In the future, a spaceship is gotten lost on the dark side of the moon when they lose power, because it turns out that the Bermuda Triangle completely aligns with a certain part of the moon where Satan was exiled, and all of the ships that have gone missing in the Bermuda Triangle are actually having their souls beamed up to the moon to Satan, and this mining vessel in the future is the 666th ship to do so. Seriously, that's the plot.
But that could be good.
It's not, because it's so blandly directed, and they clearly didn't have the money. The entire film is shot in two shots and close-ups to hide the lack of sets and how cheap the costumes look. And you go, that plot needed to be done bigger.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you needed to produce this more, where Michael Bay needs to step back one or two. For something like Dark Side of the Moon, you need to ramp it up one or two, because it just becomes a boring talk fest. Does that make sense?
It does, and it makes me want to watch Event Horizon again.
Yes.
Event Horizon did have an epic scale to it. But then, sometimes what people call overproduced are what I would say people that don't understand, and I hate this term because this is going to be the snobbiest thing I've ever said. They don't know film language. Mm. Look at a movie like David Fincher's Seven. People talk about how stylized it is, and they get over the fact that you didn't even notice what he did to you. Like, you'll notice before Somerset and Mills are close, it's full of wide shots and two shots. And then after they start to become close, as the film progresses and the story starts to come together, the shots are tighter. The angles are tighter. The characters are closer. Fincher is literally using film language to get an emotional response for the characters. And it's so brilliant, you didn't even notice that he did it. That is the kind of overproduction I'm okay with. Would you agree, Glenn? Did you see that about Seven?
I can't say I've noticed that, but that's a really good observation. I wouldn't say that was overproduction. I'd say that is just clever production.
But Glenn, one of the things Seven is accused of is how slick and overproduced it is. And that's why I'm saying I don't agree with that criticism on that movie, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say it was overproduced. It is a pretty slick film, but it is very Fincher. You see any of his films and you get that kind of tightness of production in every film.
Yeah, everything in that movie is weaving itself in together to tell the story. And I know that people are used to points in movies where they can take a breath and, you know, talk to their friend, and it's just not that kind of a movie. I've been surprised when people have told me, you know, I didn't get Mulholland Drive. I'm like, but didn't you watch it? I know that it's not as straightforward as other ones.
It was a TV pilot, so yeah, it doesn't answer all the questions it brings up, which is inherently a problem with that, but...
But it at least pulls itself together. It's just not in... It answers some questions before it asks them.
That's true. But, like, you've got overproduction. Like, Glenn, have you seen the Gem trailer yet?
No, I've been actively avoiding it.
I'm sure you've seen the fallout of the Gem trailer, though, right?
Yes, I have.
Okay. I was on the phone with Sarah when she watched it. And all I could hear was her going, "That's not Rio! What the hell is this? Where are the misfits?" It was actually kind of funny. But the Gem trailer is the perfect example of this. You look at it, and it looks overproduced. And, you know, obviously the songs are all auto-tuned and whatnot, to the point where you go, you absolutely missed the point. We're not even going to get into how they screwed all the characters and the story up. But the trailer looks so overproduced that you just know that they were using that to cover with the fact that they didn't have a fucking script, you know?
No, I would disagree. They had a script. before they even started this, and then they just slapped the name on.
Which is also a fair accusation against it. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, you know, overproduction is what happens when I think you're not confident enough in the story. Now, this isn't always true, but I think when you see a film that's overproduced, it's always 99% of the time, it's one that has a weak script. Isn't it, Glenn?
It can be used as a form of compensation, yeah. I think it's all... don't really have the first clue as to what it is they've got in their hands. Certainly, from what it sounds like with this gem film, it sounds like they basically looked around, found a product, and went, okay, let's make a film around this, and didn't really necessarily understand the characters or what this actually meant to the people who kind of would like to watch this. So they tend to pretty it up, and they tend to throw as many, you know, gimmicks and tricks as they can onto the screen in order to try and hopefully fool people into thinking it's a good film. And, you know, going back to Michael Bay, this is another thing that he does an awful lot of. That's why you get like an hour long fight scene, is because he knows how to do those things. And that's the downside of overproduction, is when you kind of get these one or two little things that you think you're good at, or things that you think that the audience might just settle for, and you kind of throw these things in, you throw as much money as you can possibly manage at these things and hope that people will be fooled for at least long enough to get you through the opening week.
God, Glenn, you're calling them Liefeld feet.
Yeah, the comic book nerds will get that. But like when it comes to something like Michael Bay, where I think he fails as a filmmaker is he doesn't understand audience fatigue. And now when I say the camera never stops moving in like a Michael Bay movie, like you pointed out, Glenn, he does it too much, and I agree with that. Thankfully, I can't recall one where he's on shaky cam yet, but when that camera never stops moving, the audience gets fatigued after a while. When you've got these giant robots that are just all these gears and you don't even know what you're actually looking at half the time in these fights, the audience gets mentally fatigued.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he doesn't realize.
No, and that's the sign of a limited director, is when they have those one or two things and that's all they have. That's all they can hold on to. And I think what's the other thing, really? When you come to color palettes, Michael Bay and Bruckheimer and all those ilk, really, they have those very recognizable color palettes which are used again and again and again. And it's lost all meaning. It's become this sort of shorthand in cinema to kind of indicate, I don't even know what it indicates. I don't think it indicates a damn thing these days. It just looks pretty. And that's a good example of how production can go wrong. You get these pointless oranges and blue kind of saturations on the screen, or what's happening quite often as well is desaturation of color.
That's the one I hate the most, where every movie nowadays looks like a Saw sequel.
Yeah, you know, it's the funny thing, because we've all got these much higher definition images, and you know, the big kind of the new digital projectors can project at higher resolutions and all this kind of stuff. Now they're so worried about all these. You got to make it sharp. I've got to make it high quality. You got to do this. You got to do that. You got to do the other, without thinking about how that affects the film, or how that affects the TV program. TV programs are a bugger for it with their HD. It just looks...
I actually think that when it comes to TV, they overproduce the HD. Back when I worked at Channel 32, there was always, whenever you'd go into Master Control, you'd have the HD broadcast monitor. And everything looked like a YouTube video. Everything was too separated, and it was so – I mean, like, we were running, I think, like Grey's Anatomy at the time, and I'm like, it doesn't look this bad on my TV, but the HD looks horrible. It looks like news footage.
It looks like a set. Peter Jackson had this problem with the Hobbit, the first one, because
they did it in the 70mm crap.
Yeah, and the faster frame rate and all that kind of stuff. And even he kind of had to stand back at the end of it and said it was a mistake. It just looked like what it is. It looked like a movie set. And this is the thing: you've got these very, very high production qualities which are going on. And the format hasn't really managed to cope with that, because you end up looking like it looks like you're looking at a theatre set, for instance. There's not many theatre sets out there, for instance, that will fool people. You know, you're always aware of the fact of what you're looking at. And when you do these really high quality, high definition movie sets or TV sets, you see them and it looks not like what you would expect it to look like. It looks like what it actually is, an artifice.
It looks like you pulled all the glue out.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
All you have is the edges.
Mm.
Well, but you also have that with like the new Star Treks. And now Enterprise, I know, is early 2000s, but it doesn't, it's supposed to take place before Classic Trek. But it's so overproduced. I'm not even talking about how bad the stories and whatnot are. I'm just talking about the production of Enterprise. It's so overproduced, it doesn't even look like it's part of the same franchise, let alone supposed to be a prequel. You know what I mean? Now, I'm not saying that they had to go with, you know, the 60s retro feel and whatnot, you know, the obvious 60s architecture of the old series and things like that. So, but I'm just saying it looked so new. I looked at that as, I don't think I can buy this as a prequel. It's too overproduced. But then you also have the opposite direction, where you have things that are meant to look retro, and they're so overproduced that you go, you never actually lived in the 70s, did you? Because if you look at a movie like Black Dynamite, which I think is a fantastic 70s throwback movie, it's so 70s. It's actually more 70s than an actual blaxploitation movie. That's the kind of overproduction I'm talking about. You know, Sarah, you being the young one, do you ever see that when you look at a retro thing? Because Glenn and I are old men, so you're younger. But do you ever see, like, a movie set in the – maybe a 2000s movie that's set in the 80s or something, and do you ever kind of go, why do I think actual 80s TV shows didn't look this 80s?
Yeah, I mean, that there was. I'm not going to say that I watched that 80s show, because that would be a lie. But
I actually did, because I like Shia LaBeouf.
But yeah, that I did see some of that 70s show, and I wasn't sure if they were doing it as an homage or if we were actually supposed to believe that they existed within that time frame, because on top of just and the clothes and the hair, which I guess they got, there's no way for me to really say yes or no on that. The characterizations, it was like, you're trying to do modern humor, but say that you're in the 70s, and 70s humor was different than modern humor, and there goes my eyes.
So, I mean, Glenn, you're from the 70s, same as I am, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, when you look at something like All in the Family, you look at an episode of like All in the Family and you go, that's very 70s. And then you look at something like a 90s sitcom and just say it was set in the 70s, it doesn't work, does it?
No, and a lot of that's quite often to do with the aesthetic of the image that you're being shown. When it's a very clearly modern either projection or transmission, you know, the picture looks, well, the picture looks modern. You know, you're not looking at it on a much lower resolution CRT, for instance. Because nowadays you're watching it on a big flat screen in high definition, and everything's really crisp and perfect, and the sound's in kind of 16.5 bloody Dolby surround system.
Hmm. Yeah. And it was shot in mono.
Yes. When you got those differences, yeah, it's very difficult to sort of do the match up. But then you've got the other ones, I guess, like the Grindhouse films.
Grindhouse was the definition of overproduced.
Exactly. You know, I mean, you looked at that. And we've mentioned this before, you know, where you have something which is trying to be a fake of that. You know, it's trying to be fake bad or kind of deliberately look downgraded and low budget and all that kind of stuff. And it's a perfect example of the lengths of overproduction they actually have to go to try to make something look like the days when it was completely underproduced. And isn't that such a weird dichotomy?
That shouldn't be that hard. Like, like the Grindhouse movie, they shot it all in HD and then added all the digital defects and everything digitally.
Yeah.
Why not go back and get some 70s cameras and 70s film stock, which you can still get, and actually shoot it like you would have in the 70s.
Yeah, and half your budget.
in a lot of cases, yeah, it would be cheaper to actually go to Goodwill and find old equipment than to use CGI to make it look like you found old equipment.
Mm-hmm. Especially since you know that at least one of them lives over here in LA. It's not like it's hard to find things like that here.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But overproduction is not just, you know, to video and whatnot. You get this in music as well. Now, sometimes it's to hide defects. Like, did you guys ever hear the raw vocals of Courtney Love that were released before all of the audio engineering had gone into it?
No, I'm scared now.
Was that the live one?
Yeah. She didn't pay her audio tech for one of her last albums, so he released the actual vocals that she sung versus what you heard on the album.
Is this like when Katy Perry sang on that morning show when they didn't have the super voice fixer all set up for her?
I guess. I don't follow Katy Perry, so I'll trust you on that.
Let's just say that there were cats that called in and went, I feel like you're giving me a bad name. Stop doing that.
There's a possibility, because in music, the biggest thing you can do is that you'll notice is when you go see a band live, it doesn't sound anything like the same song on the album. And in some cases, you can chalk it up to, well, there's different acoustics in here and they have different equipment. But mm-hmm. in many cases, it's because they have gone through so much post-production, so much fine-tuning, that what was actually recorded is not even close to what actually wound up on the album. And a lot of people don't realize that when it comes to music, you're actually hearing much more of the computer and the engineer than you are the actual band.
Well, that's like people who don't understand that an actor doesn't look like they do on the screen at all times. There's not only makeup and hair, but there's the post-production. Let's just take those wrinkles off, and now somebody can fap to her.
Do you realize that Ghost Rider, the Nicolas Cage movie, had a specific CG animator whose sole job was to add hair to Nicolas Cage's head? With CG, his soul. Read the credits. Nick Cage CG hair wrangler. I mean, I'm not quoting that, but yeah, there is a specific guy credited with making sure Nicolas Cage's hair, the CG, looks right from frame to frame.
Josh, do you put that on your resume?
No.
I would love to see that in the extras on the DVD. An interview with the hair wrangler.
Hell, in Watchmen, there was a specific CG wrangler to make sure Dr. Manhattan's penis moved realistically.
Was it a wang wrangler?
No, it'd be a wangler.
Yes, and you would have to have a model for that, wouldn't you?
I would think so, but yes, that's the kind of overproduction that you get nowadays. I don't think you need that. But,
yeah, we don't want a stiff and lifeless cock on screen, do you? Come on.
Come on, that thing looks so fake. But, I mean, that's what I'm talking about with overproduction. You even have it in video games. Now, we were always happy as kids that with the video game, you know, you've got a background that moves and whatnot. Now you have to have what's called fully destructible environments. It doesn't even matter, but your lightsaber needs to be able to cut that tree down. It doesn't have anything to do with the game or the plot, just it has to be a fully... I've seen that as a complaint on some modern games. The backgrounds are just painted on. You've got no interaction with the background. Is the background why you bought the game, or did you buy the game to shoot motherfuckers in the face with a shotgun?
Well, yeah, you can shoot them in the face with a shotgun, but if you walk through the water, you want to have there to be little bits of rust on your gun after 3 weeks, because that's more realistic.
And to me, that's overproduction I don't need. In fact, you don't even notice it. Nowadays, I'm so spoiled at this. And yeah, I'm guilty of it. When I'm playing an older game that does not have a fully destructible environment, but it has 3D rendered backgrounds, I'm kind of like, okay, why is my sword just bouncing off this box? Why can I not destroy this box? Son of a bitch! It's just painted on background!
Josh, I don't know if you're going to play the new Witcher game,
probably not.
one of the things that people are going crazy over is that it has realistic beard growth.
Really? Because
yes.
That's what we needed.
The audience demanded it. They never asked me.
Fine, fair enough. But, I mean, like, to go back to one thing Sarah said a little bit ago, that an actor doesn't look like what they look like, there's actually a website online that finds porn stars on their days off. It's called Porn Stars Without Makeup. And then they have, like, what you look like in the porn, and then what they look like, you know, grocery shopping for cat litter. And they aren't even close to the... You go, whoa, I don't know if I'd get hard fucking the chick buying cat litter, but it's the same chick. That's the kind of overproduction we're talking about. I mean, back in the porns I like from the 70s and 80s, they might use makeup to cover up a bullet wound in her ass or something, but not to make her look prettier, you know?
Well, can I say that you would not want them to wear that much makeup when they go to the grocery store? The last there was a place that I went to a bit because I had no other choice, and there was a person who used to be known in the 80s, and she goes grocery shopping wearing about 3 inches of makeup and really short skirts. So it's scary in real life.
Yeah, I've met enough famous people in real life to know that there's a difference between ones that are saying, I'm still a star, at least in my mind, and I have to look at, and others that are going, yeah, I got old, deal. So, but another thing about overproduction, now, Glenn, I know you'll get this because of, because I know you watch a lot of TV. When it comes to long-running story arcs that people like to produce in their mind way out in advance. Like, I call bullshit on what happened on Sons of Anarchy. Did you ever watch that one, Glenn or Sarah?
I haven't seen it, but I have friends who are crazy about it.
I've never caught it.
Okay. Apparently there's lots of rape.
There's a lot of male rape in it, but it's a biker gang show. And, you know, just starting in the first season, there's certain characters, and then a main character gets killed in a big dramatic moment in season 6. It's a 7-season show. And the producer and head writer goes, I always knew we were going to kill Tara in season 6. Yeah, because when you wrote the pilot, you already knew you were going to last for 7 fucking seasons? My ass. Or is that just way over production, just assuming you're going to get 7 seasons? You know, Glenn, I know, like with Max Headroom, they were writing these things one episode at a time.
Yes.
They were, I mean, and that's a show that was really produced. Look at the goddamn production design. That show is so fucking detailed. It's insane. And yet, they were just making up each episode as they went, and if it worked into an arc, hey, fine. And it did, because they were good writers.
Yeah, I mean, there is a difference between having a lot of production elements in a film or TV or whatever, and it being overly produced. And I think Max Headroom, there's a few points where it probably skirted that, but it, for the most part, it kept its feet its heart and soul basically in the right place. It didn't let that kind of go too far. The nature of something like that in any way is that it's going to have very high production values. If you take something like The Matrix, for instance, though, the not the first one so much, but certainly the second and the third one, those two sequels were extraordinarily overproduced. They had all the money in the world, all the screen time that they could have, all the resources that any studio could afford to give them, and look what happened.
And the films are dreadful.
Ended up being incredibly bloated, undisciplined, unfocused. And that didn't happen with the first one, because the first one had limitations. They had to do a certain amount with relatively little in comparison to the sequels, certainly. And the first one, it basically says, well, you've got to make a self-contained film, which they did. The second and third one, it's like, well, you've got as much time as you want and there's all the resources you can possibly imagine to do exactly what you want to do, and we won't have a word to say about it. And that's what's happened. But the Wachowskis, most of their films have suffered with that to a certain degree.
Speed Racer is probably the most overproduced film I've ever attempted to sit through. But, I mean, it even goes back to 80s television. When I was interviewing Joe Dante, now, he directed episodes of Amazing Stories and of the new Twilight Zone in 85. And he said a perfect example of the stark difference between the two shows was the production. Because he said Amazing Stories had all the money in the world and no ideas. Twilight Zone was overflowing with ideas and fantastic scripts, and they had no money. So you look at something like Amazing Stories, which is, you look at it now, it's shallow, it's pointless, and the editor in me watching some of these sees so many things that could be cut out and were unnecessary to tell the story. But they had, you got to remember, this is a lot of money in 1985, $1 million an episode to produce 22 minutes of content.
Mm-hmm.
That's insane! But it's Spielberg.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at Twilight Zone, and the effects are crappy. The acting is great, but the sets and costumes aren't very good. But the stories are so innovative and amazing! That's the kind of contrast between overproduction versus underproduction. Now, if you could just get the big budget from Amazing Stories over to Twilight Zone, you'd have had a perfect anthology show!
I wonder if that's the case, though, because there are plenty, there would have been a lot more opportunities for the directors to, shall we say, indulge themselves. And I think I've used this example before. Day of the Dead was supposed to be a much, much larger world and all that kind of stuff, and it had to get pared down. George Romero couldn't do quite the film he wanted to do, and I think it ended up being a better film because of it, because I think if he'd got the money, he got the chance to do exactly what he wanted to do, it would have been a mess to a much greater degree than a lot of people said Day of the Dead was. I actually happen to think it's a really good film.
I actually think Day of the Dead might be, I don't know if it's my favorite of the Dead franchise. I think it's the best of the Dead franchise when it comes to quality, though.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it is a beautiful looking film, and you know, everything about it is just really quite classy. Even the over-the-top acting is kind of something.
But I'm running this goddamn monkey farm now!
Have you seen the remake?
One of my favorite lines, by the way.
Did you see the remake?
Oh, the fucking one with Ving Rhames and all the racist jokes and all the racist. Oh, you know what? I don't know what happened to Steve Miner. That's not the same Steve Miner I grew up watching movies from that made that thing.
No, and that's incredible, because I mean, the thing is, they had more opportunities to be able to do a bigger story, a more accomplished piece of filmmaking in technical respects, at the very least. It wasn't exactly a huge budget or anything like that, but given the technology that's available these days, there's so much they could have done. But they just kind of went completely in a weird direction. I mean, who the fuck thought of a vegetarian zombie?
Well, who the fuck thought Survival of the Dead was a good idea?
Well, of the remake that I'm thinking that the part that I liked about it was a quiet part that had no overproduction in it. It was just the two groups of people talking to each other via signs. It's simple. It works.
The Dawn of the Dead remake, that was a great scene. Mm-hmm. Even Romero pointed that out, that he's like, that's the only thing that really one-upped my version.
You don't need money and effects if you have a good idea. I know that the horse, it is paced at this point, but...
Well, but like, did either of you guys see the TV series Numbers from the early 2000s ever?
Yeah, I saw that. That was with the two brothers, and one of them was mathematician.
The other was the crazy. FBI, yeah.
Yeah.
Did you see that one, Glenn?
No, I didn't.
Well, it lasted like 7 seasons or something like that. Mm-hmm. Now, the aired pilot didn't do this, but I saw the unaired pilot.
Ah! Oh! Sorry.
Sarah's phone. The Jesus, was that loud? Was it in your microphone?
It's something klaxon.
but the Numbers unaired pilot is the most overproduced thing I've ever seen for 45 minutes. Mm-hmm. I know they were trying to sell this to the network, but they had everything you could think of in this. Crossfades and CGI, and you had like almost thought bubbles and footage sped up and slowed down, and the camera spins around Matrix style, and it was like the editor of the pilot got a new software package and said, I want to use one of everything in this pilot. And I mean my wife and I were getting fatigued watching this 45 minute pilot, going like, my God, every kind of video effect you can think of is in this pilot. I can't watch this.
Yes, but did he use a star wipe?
He did use wipes, but not a star wipe, probably. But it was just one of the most overproduced things I've ever seen. And thankfully, they didn't do that for the aired version, but it was like, why did you think using one of everything was going to sell this to CBS?
That's the thing. You get too many toys, you kind of end up making a very bad film.
But I can understand it. When you get a new toy, you want to play with it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But discipline goes a hell of a long way.
Yeah. So I think overproduction, it hurts. But sometimes you just need to get two people together. Like, this is tangentially related to Michael Bay, but Michael Bay directed videos for Meatloaf. And Meatloaf's song, directed by Michael Bay for I'd Do Anything for Love, But I Won't Do That, is considered the most overproduced song of all time. I can't disagree with that. It also is a fucking epic, awesome song. I can't disagree with the overproduction thing. But then you look at, like, when Meatloaf sings it live, look at some of the footage on YouTube, and you just kind of go, it's kind of bland.
Mm-hmm.
It needs that overproduction, you know? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, but then, you know, Meatloaf has always been that kind of big-blown operatic kind of show. In fact, you know, I mean, I've worked plenty of actual operas, and they always have that kind of massive event kind of feel to them. Whether you like them or not is one thing, and either one thing or the other. But certain types of art forms do need to be big and boisterous and kind of right in your face. Certainly, Michael Bay, when he does his films, he's directed an awful lot of films like they are music videos. But like they're 2.5 to 3 hour long music videos, which is, you know, what he does is great in the context of something like a music video, because you've got a 2-3 minute piece. You can throw an awful lot of stuff in there. You can be very flamboyant and just
or even vulgar. In the case of the Meatloaf video, look at the video for I'd Do Anything for Love, But I Won't Do That. It's a 7-minute video that probably cost $5 million. Because it's almost like it's a short film.
Oh, yeah, absolutely it is. And that's the thing he's very good at, is doing that kind of short film. When it's been expanded out, he's always seemed to really struggle, and then he kind of goes to his fallback tricks to try and pad it out. And for some reason, he just does not want to kind of go, okay, I'm going to make a 90-minute film. Because this is, if he stopped at a certain point and says, this is what I've got to offer you, it's going to be big, it's going to be loud, it's going to be 90 minutes, great. It's when he kind of keeps going, oh, the audience liked this bit, so I'll give them more of that, and a bit more of that, and a bit more of that, and a bit more of that. And it's like feeding a 6-year-old chocolate cake. It's good up until a certain point, but the more you keep doing it, the more they're going to get sick of it.
The more you keep screwing, the more chafed you become.
Yes.
Eventually you're going to chafe.
Yeah, well, you have to get lube, and you know where to get that from.
AdamandEve.com. Use the promo code static. But
there you go.
But you know, the last thing I want to say about this is, go back and look at a TV show like Miami Vice. Back in the day, Miami Vice was the biggest show on television. Biggest budget, and it looked it. It looked, I don't want to say overproduced, because they were going for a very specific music video style. Remember, the pitch that got Miami Vice picked up was MTV Cops. So that fit. But Miami Vice had enough good writers on its staff that you were still able to get good stories in there. So while it's very overproduced, it had the quiet moments. It had the parts where you go, okay, this whole thing is a build-up to the huge, monstrous Michael Bay, John Milius-style shootout in the last 10 minutes. So I think I don't know if I would call Miami Vice overproduced. I would just say it was produced on the level it needed to be at the time. I mean, hell, when you've got episodes directed by Abel Ferrara, you go, I don't know if I'd call that overproduced, would you?
I would say that they were good at showing their work. You know, that there's a difference between that. I'm going to go over to the craft store, and I'm going to put beads and baubles and flowers and all this kinds of shit on my car because more is better. There's a difference between that and going, you know what? All I need is a really good speaker and a car that works, and those two things together, I'm golden.
Well, Glenn Criddle, you're obviously not overproduced when you do your nasties. You do just the right amount of production. Where can people see you do that?
You can find me on that's very nice, thank you.
I was trying to backhand, but I wasn't quite sure if I did it right.
You can find me on YouTube as LampyNam101, or you can find me at Geek Juice Media.
And Sarah, you produce some very nice comics. With the relaunch coming up, there's a bunch that haven't aired, popped up, posted, whatever you want to say yet. But you've got stuff. Where is that?
Well, you'll find my productions and judge their quality on 1201beyond.com. You can find me on the Facebooks and the Twitters and... Well, not so much the Twitters, but the Facebooks. I'm there occasionally. And up on DeviantArt, under my nom de plume, they have a whole bunch of old stuff. So go look at that and put it in your face.
Your nom de plume is?
Anna McKeon.
There you go. And you can contact this show at 1201beyond@gmail.com, and also go to 1201beyond.com for more shows like this, stuff by Sarah, obviously stuff by Glenn and whatnot. And we're relaunching very soon, so it'll have a new look, and it'll be retro, but not overproduced.
Lost in the Static is a 1201 Beyond production. Visit 1201beyond.com for more great shows.